FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's 10-10-17. We're finishing up a tumultuous year. It wasn't enough that the markets went to record highs. We had Mother Nature almost under continuing assault in the previous quarter. What else can happen? Where are we heading? Well, with us now is Lynette Zhang, Chief Market Analyst at ITM Trading. She's been following markets, well, I don't really want to say how long you've been following markets.
Well, on some level, different markets, but since 1964, and I don't hide my age.
Yeah,
I'm 63.
So almost. Since Kennedy was president, I think he was assassinated in 63. So since LBJ occupied the White House, you know, Lynette, it's amazing how many people we've seen come and go from that place, from 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. What I really appreciate, though, is your data-based approach towards analyzing the market. No, I feel this, I think that, or disguising what you really feel or think in terms of sounding rational. Hey, as always, you can send us an email. Any questions, comments for myself or Lynette, kl@kerrylutz.com. Hey, Lynette, welcome to the show. I'm really glad you're on.
Well, thank you very much, Kerry. I'm very happy to be here today.
Hey, so before we talk about cryptocurrencies or what I've nicknamed kleptocurrencies, because most of them are just an excuse or a mechanism for stealing hapless, I don't want to say investors, because that would be offering them too much respect. Well, let's say speculators. Just basically a way to abscond with speculators' funds. Central banking. So you've been a student of central banking for a lot of years, and
yes.
We seem to be at a bit of a crossroads now, don't we?
Well, a crossroads, I would say more of a transition than a crossroads, because they've stated quite clearly, and the current system, which is based on debt, it no longer functions. It died in 2008. And so they've been getting us ready for a new money standard. And we're in that transition to that new money standard.
Okay, so the new money standard. And are you saying this with some knowledge of what's going on, or is this?
Yeah, absolutely. If I can't prove it, I don't say it. It's very simple, but actually the central bankers themselves have been calling for a new money standard really quite vocally since 2011, when the IMF produced their paper on how they would transition to the SDR. But in 2000, and the SDR was created to take over as the world reserve currency from the U.S. dollar back in 69. So it just Kissinger made an agreement with Saudi Arabia on the petrodollar. So they didn't need to make that transition then, but now they're the only alternative. So yes, I'm there's not one little doubt in my mind about this transition and what they intend. And you called them kleptocurrencies before, cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, crypto, what's the difference?
Well, the IMF is going to have their own crypto currency, and that'll be the world reserve currency. Yeah.
All right. So, are the people of the world, are we just going to be like the sheeple of the world? Are you just going to go willingly off to slaughter here?
I'm not. And, you know, so I'm trying to help people understand what's happening, because even though I think it's inevitable, what is not inevitable and where we still have the at least the opportunity, maybe possibility, is to maintain our choices. I mean, in 33, they engineered the 1929 stock market crash to make this transition. And they took our choice. The only way that we could protect ourselves was the gold standard, because gold holds your purchasing power.
Mm-hmm.
So they used that crisis to take us from the gold standard to the fiat money standard. And fiat is by decree. That's a paper money standard that was partially backed by gold. And then that transition ended in 71. And I mean, quite honestly, when I sit and I look at back at my life during that period of time and my awareness level, I mean, truthfully, I had a dollar in my pocket in July of 71. I had a dollar in my pocket in September of 71. The common thing was the dollar. But the reality is it went from something that had some gold backing to something that was purely debt backing.
Yeah, which
and I'm pretty sure we're going to have a crypto U.S. dollar, too. It'll probably be the dollar coin because it's that name that people are married to. Oh, the dollar can never go away. That's just a name. Yeah. So, yeah, there will be an additional crisis where these highly elevated markets will implode. It'll take down a lot of the crypto space as well because most of it is garbage. I mean, it actually all is just an algorithm. It's a mathematical formula. So it'll take that down. And then the central banks will usher in their own cryptocurrencies that are so much safer.
Yeah, and, federally backed.
Right. And take the dollar bills. Not that the dollars protect your purchasing power, because they don't. Yeah. But at least if they go to negative interest rates and they try to steal your principal, you can pull the dollars, physical cash, out of your bank and at least make an attempt to preserve your principal, not your purchasing power, but your principal. Once everything is in cyberspace, which is what they want, they say there are no limits to how low we can push interest rates. In other words, how quickly we can rob you of your principal. We've already taken your purchasing savings. Power. Now we want your principal.
Your principal and your savings. Yeah, exactly. So let's go back to something you said there, that the 1929 crash, the Great Depression, engineered by certain parties. All right.
100%.
Tell me who,
and I have the proof.
Who did it, and tell me your proof.
Okie doke. Well, the proof comes from the Federal Reserve themselves. And if anybody wants the link to this proof, I am very, very happy to send it. I can give it to you. You can send it out, or they can call us and we'll send it out.
I'll put it in the show notes. Yeah.
Okay. So here's the proof. Prior to 1913, a 20th of an ounce of gold backed a $1 gold certificate, and they were absolutely interchangeable. When they legalized the Federal Reserve in their charter, which was a 20-year charter, they had the right and ability to print $2.4 for every dollar's worth of gold. So now that 20th of an ounce of gold backed $2.40, and that is exactly what they did. They printed almost 2.5 times the money based upon the gold reserves. So during that period of time, purchasing power dropped by 50%. This is all according to the Federal Reserve. Now, if you were to see your purchasing power drop 50% in a short period of time, so if you as an individual were to see your purchasing power over a short period of time drop by 50%, you probably would notice and go, what is going on? But of course, they don't want you to know when the shift is occurring. So that leaving the barter ratio the same means that everybody, or the average income, I should say, tripled during that same period of time. Well, gosh, if your income triples, but your costs double, do you really care that your costs double? No.
No.
So they always, and this is 100% of the time, they always want the normal person to experience some gains during that period of time so that you aren't really looking at the sleight of hand.
Right.
So when a central bank creates money, the first place it goes is into the banking system.
Of course.
And then the banks loan it out, right? Stocks, bonds, real estate. Well, there's your 1929. But now the industrialists at that period, normal people were not in the stock market. That was for the very wealthy, the industrialists, you know, the nouveau riche. And so they knew a lot of the garbage that was going on, but the general population now felt wealthy. So they wanted to emulate them. They started moving into, and it is kind of interesting, in 27, for the first time ever in history, the Federal Reserve as a central bank was granted a perpetual charter.
Right.
So where the original charter would have been over in 33, I don't think this is a coincidence, now it became a perpetual charter. Then in 28, the industrialists, the guys that were in the know, the insiders, sold into the naive public. That's why every Wednesday I do an insider trading. It's like, let's look at what the guys that know what's going on are doing. But the public didn't know. The banks were giving them, I mean, margin debt was at all-time highs. They were allowing them to borrow and spend and borrow and spend and borrow and spend. And then when they felt that there was enough insider money out and they were ready for this next piece, they pulled the credit punch bowl. 1929 happened. We went into a depression because of it. They dropped interest rates to zero. We think this is the first time it happened. No, that's not true.
For sure.
No, happened back then. Then they used that excuse to confiscate the gold from the population because that was the only tool that we had to hold purchasing power and hold politicians' toes to the fire. And there, and then we're off to the races. You can look on the Federal Reserve Fed purchasing power chart, and you can see that whole transition quite easily. But I have all the backup from the Federal Reserve. And I'm, again, I'm happy to send that out to anybody that wants to look at it. It's interesting reading.
Yeah. And then once the collapse hit, once the Great Depression hit, then purchasing power went way, way up on the dollar at that point, right?
Well, that's what it looked like. And actually, when you look at that chart and you can go back and look at it, for that range in 2008, too, and you'll see a very similar movement. What that actually represents is not how great things got for the public, but all of the wealth that transferred hands from the public to the few at the top.
Yeah. Well, I remember.
That's actually what that represents.
I remember my parents telling me, like, my grandfather had houses with like 20% mortgages, and those are the, you know, it had, he had 80% equity or 60%. Those are the ones they foreclosed upon, not the ones where it was underwater and they were going to lose money foreclosing. So fast forward to 08-09.
Exactly.
Fast forward to 08-09. Was it the same kind of triggered collapse?
Well, okay, you're going a little too far. Let's kind of back up.
Okay.
Because a lot of things shifted in the 90s. And in 97, I mean, think about 71, we went on to a pure debt system. And in a pure debt system, that means a debt needs to constantly compound. But when you first take on debt, and you spend that money, you are stimulating your current economy and you'll pay it back later. So in that case, in the new system from the 70s, taking on debt was economically stimulated. And you can see that in the monetary velocity charts. But by 97, that's when we actually hit the peak debt, or the ability for that continuing, because we've continued to create a lot more debt, but it has not been economically stimulating as witnessed by the monetary velocity chart, which is the speed at which money changes hands, and it indicates whether or not an economy is being stimulated. So what they also did during that period of time, because now the banks in 71, Nixon really handed over the full power of inflation to the banks. And what do banks know? They know debt and they know leverage. So once the debt had peaked, not saying they didn't grow more debt, but once it was no longer stimulative, they really knew in 97, because it was tested with long-term capital management. That was the start of the speculative derivatives. And that actually almost blew up the entire economy, those derivatives did back then. But the taxpayer bailed them out, as well as Wall Street. They blocked oversight. They allowed commercial banks that take deposits to merge with investment banks that take risk. Okay.
Of course.
And the run-up to the speculative derivatives, which is leverage on top of leverage on top of leverage. Nobody really knows the level at risk. That's what popped in 2008. And they tested, you know, we call it the Lehman moment. That was my alma mater when I became a stockbroker. You know, it was through Lehman in Sarasota, Florida, actually.
Ah.
And, you know, I couldn't believe that they would let Lehman go out. But, you know, it was the same kind of thing. Credit froze. And within 24 hours, even though we saw it coming, you know, we had technical indicators right along. For me, in 2007, when the dollar dropped to its lowest level against the standard weighted basket, that was a real trigger that something nasty this way comes. And, you know, so in 2008, when the system imploded, every single thing that the central bankers have done since October of 2008 has been purely experimental. The old tools that they had given themselves at the start of this game do not work anymore. So they knew at that point that they had to, that they had to, you know, finish preparing the shift.
Right.
And, you know, and amazingly, and I don't know, coincidence? But also in the end of the 90s, that's when the NSA did a white paper on creating cryptocurrencies. And look at the index. They use the same verbiage. They use a lot of the same. I mean, the outline is right there. And then I recently just stumbled across in my research in 90. No, that was the white paper. The NSA white paper is 96. I'm sorry. In 97. I found a peer review journal on smart contracts. So these things were all planned since the end of the 90s. And I really don't think, I can't prove this. So this is my opinion, but I don't think that it was an accident that Bitcoin was born in 2009 at the same time that quantitative easing was born.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
don't think that's an accident.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting. We don't really know who created Bitcoin or anything, right?
Right.
It's a mystery.
Right. Maybe.
So far it's a mystery. There's no proof who created it, where it came,
right. Yeah,
who's profiting from it, who had all those coins initially. But we do know that it's been quite a ride for Bitcoin. So we've got this coming. What's going to happen once we go to SDRs? And is the world just going to accept it? I mean,
well,
do we have a choice?
Well, number one, we vote with our purses. So if you adopt it, then you accept it and you're voting to accept it. I don't know that we really have a choice. The momentum is tremendous right now. And you see more and more countries that are adopting it. And certainly all of the money that's going in there from the banking sector, you know, the financial sector, as well as the non-financial corporations is pretty significant. So what I would like to see is, number one, I've been using significantly more cash in my day-to-day living than I typically was, because certainly it's a whole lot more convenient to use your credit card or your debit card, or, you know, I don't know how convenient these cryptocurrencies are. I'm not hearing the convenience level in there yet.
Yeah, try buying a coffee at 7-Eleven, and the Indian guy there is gonna toss you out, right? I mean...
Well, for the moment, yes, but probably not for too much longer, because they are on a push for adoption. Yeah. But one thing that would thwart them, because they tested in India taking all of that cash away that quickly, and they've had a lot of challenges because of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I just recently read the bank and did a report on the Bank for International Settlements on central bank cryptocurrencies. And also there was the report from the IMF in 2008, breaking below the lower zero bound, which talks about how to take us cashless. So what they need is they need us to volunteer. And they say it in their documents. I mean, I show it all the time, where they want distance between what their choice is and for the public to acknowledge it. So, you know, you really are not far off, Kerry, when you say that, you know, 7-Eleven doesn't want to accept Bitcoin today, but they want 7-Eleven to introduce Bitcoin, or at the least, you know, attaching it to your Visa MasterCard, which is also pushing to go cashless, right? And they, you know, I talked about Octchain, but Visa and MasterCard are right in there in helping this push. Okay.
Definitely.
And, right. So they will, you know, what they're going to do is, if you go in to buy, and I never buy soda, so I really don't know how much it costs, but you know, let's say a can of soda costs $1. Okay, well, if you're going to use your Visa or MasterCard, you know, your debit or credit card, whatever, it'll cost you $1. But if you're going to use cash, it's going to cost you $2.
Yeah.
Well, what are you likely to do?
Right, of course.
Right? And that's actually the plan that they stated in 2015's Breaking Below the Lower Zero Bound. Mm-hmm. Is you just introduce, they know how to do it. They said they can have it in place within weeks during the next crisis. And I could easily see, anybody could see how. It's a great read. Just Google it, IMF, Breaking Below the Lower Zero Bound. And it's just charging you to use cash, charging you to withdraw it, charging you to deposit it, charging you to use it. You go, well, you know, why?
Mm.
So, and then once they reach that critical mass. So for me, I say use more cash, make it that much harder for them and go more local.
Yeah, that's true too. Well, one thing you notice is the quality of the physical currency in circulation has dramatically deteriorated. Anecdotal evidence, I had a friend who was in the ATM business. Finally, they just said, we can't deal with this anymore. The machines are constantly jamming because you don't get crisp new bills. It used to be you went to the ATM and the cash that came out was sparkling new, untouched by human hands. Now it's like fit for the garbage can. I wrote a paper about this almost 3 years ago, Operation Dirty Money, that this is part of it, that they want to make cash, stigmatizing the use of cash and pushing you through. Oh, it's so much more convenient to use your credit card. Isn't it more convenient to just have prearranged transfers instead of using checks and things like that? And it's all part of it. And you've seen these guys like Lawrence Summers and many others
out. He's one of my least favorite people on the planet. I have no respect for that. I think he's evil. In my opinion, he's evil.
Well, he certainly does not have your best interests at hand.
No.
That much I'll go. As far as how evil he might be, well, you know, how did they get
I don't know. But I mean, knowing full well that the entire global financial system barely escaped implosion.
Yeah.
He was the one that ushered in the repeal of Glass-Steagall.
Oh, for sure.
Which was put in place because of what happened in, you know, in 29.
Exactly. Yeah.
So,
separating, you know, commercial from investment banking and turned the entire financial system into a casino again.
There was
a reason why they got rid of options after the Great Depression. And it wasn't just because nobody could figure out how to use them and how to make money. Everybody loses money on options. But, you know, it was because...
except for the exchanges.
Yeah, the exchanges and the people writing them, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's it. So there was a reason they got rid of futures and options markets because they were rampant during the Depression, during the run-up to the Depression.
Exactly.
And they got rid of them as part of fixing what happened. So all right, so we do have a little bit, but basically this thing is going to be a done deal when they need to do it, pretty much, is what you're saying, right?
Yep.
And there's no stopping it, so...
I don't think there is, but I do think that there are things that the individual can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to be prepared to be as independent as possible. So that means, you know, food, water, energy, security, barterability, wealth preservation, and community.
Yeah. Yeah. Community is super important. That's one thing I learned during the recent hurricane is not enough family, not enough community connections for myself because I just moved where I am recently. And you really have to, it's really important to have that. Really important.
Oh, exactly. You see, you've experienced it. And that's another thing that's happened over the years is that breakdown of the community and the family unit and the connection to other people. I mean, you know, sometimes I wonder, you know, I mean, I'm, at my age, you know, I mean, am I like one of these old people going, oh, I just don't like change? And I know that's not really true. I can see the advantage of the convenience, but I can see the other side of it too. Yeah. And, you know, just kind of going back to something, you know, really that I've started to just recently talk about in that community space is the local space. I mean, if you buy everything through Amazon, that means that Amazon is going to end up being the biggest employer. And we have a lot of evidence that Amazon employees are not so happy. Yeah. They don't get paid very well.
Oh, God.
You know, the stores that are forced to work through Amazon because people aren't shopping locally, or they'll go into a store, a local mom and pop, who really is the biggest employer in your community, right? Mm-hmm. They'll go into a mom and pop shop, and then they'll look and see if they can find it cheaper on Amazon, and they'll go out, walk out the door and buy it on Amazon. Well, Amazon, you know, in many cases, they, and for many, many years, didn't charge sales tax. Mm-hmm. Your local shop has to sell to charge sales tax.
Of course, yeah.
Amazon's model was, we don't have to make money, and Wall Street gave them a ton of money, which does kind of sound like what happened with the NASDAQ bubble in the 90s. But there's a different model on Wall Street these days, and it's not about making money. It's about funding.
Yeah.
And not making money.
They get their fees.
Well, yes, but also the investors, mm-hmm. or the people that are investing our money. If you deposit into a 401k or a mutual fund or an ETF, all these guys, Amazon just recently kind of sort of broke even.
Yeah, it was a big deal.
Exactly. But they go into an industry and they annihilate that industry, annihilate them, because the playing field is not level.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Well, I got to agree with you. You made a lot of good points there, Lynette. People want to find out more about what you're doing, read your work. Where do they find you?
Great. Well, we have our own YouTube channel, which is ITM Trading. So if you just put in YouTube ITM Trading, and I do reports every single week, three of them actually. And also they can give us a call at 888-696-4653. If you have any questions, I have a great intelligent team back there. So everybody has access. But, you know, give us a call. We're happy to send you any links or any images, and that's how they can get a hold of us.
All right. And we will have a link to your site in the show notes to this interview on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Make sure you sign up for our free newsletter and find us. Well, send us an email, questions for Lynette or myself, kl@carrielutz.com. Twitter feed's @CarrieLutz, and the Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. Lynette, it's been a total pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on, and we will talk to you again real soon.
It's been my pleasure, Carrie. You be safe in Florida. Hopefully no more hurricanes.
Let us hope and pray.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.